We're talking with Brad Barker, president and founder of the Halo Corporation, and are opening up the phone lines right after this with your questions. So I hope you've got some good ones. Stay with us for much more Coast to Coast AM. Brad, one other question before we go to the phones. You must get some strange requests that come into the office for service. You know, things like, hey, I need you to kill my wife, or I want you to kidnap somebody for me, right?
We've gotten a couple of those, sure. I expect I might get one or two after this broadcast as well. You should see the emails I'm getting.
And do you? What do you do with those kind of things? Do you alert law enforcement? Same kind of question, though, with bits and pieces. You must gather your own intelligence and pick up some interesting tidbits, say, about terror organizations. Do you pass those along?
Sure. Well, thankfully, we have such a close relationship with the law enforcement, the intelligence community here in the United States that we can have a very matter-of-fact conversation, like a couple of guys talking in a Starbucks. And you know, Halo doesn't have any response or interdiction capability. We're not law enforcement, so we act just like a private citizen, and we pass this stuff to the appropriate authorities, and then off we go.
Any laundry list of the strange requests that you can share with us? Anything come to mind?
You know, after the Discovery Channel show, we did get a fair amount of folks saying that only Halo is qualified to track down some of the aliens that have been sighted in their backyards and things of that nature, and that the CIA is reading my mind and trying to influence me. I've gotten a couple of those calls. Very concerned citizens calling, very concerned for my safety and well-being. So I was touched, but we didn't take much action on that.
Well, get on that alien stuff. Let us know what you find out, because I'd like to answer that one myself. Go to the wild card line, Dale in Montana. Good morning, Dale. Hello, Dale.
Whatever. Anyway, gentlemen, a short note and then a follow-up question. I was raised in El Paso, 1952 to 1974, until I moved to Montana, where my dad was from. And I lived literally in the lower Rio Grande Valley, 1 mile from the Rio Grande. And the lower Rio Grande Valley is basically the poorer part of El Paso. The upper Rio Grande Valley was a more affluent. Now, we back then never had any racial problems whatsoever growing up in the 60s. I never knew I was a minority. We get along great with everybody. Most of my friends, we were all Mexican related. I mean, we were all good buddies and everything. And we didn't have the big drug problems at the time. And then, of course, it slowly changed. And what really made the big change was when the big three in 68 and 69 started opening the plants in Juarez and using the cheap labor and everything. And thousands came from the interior of Mexico to Juarez to work to get those jobs. And my question is, what effect do you think all of the overpopulation in Mexico have in this war on the drug cartel? And El Paso, the corridor of El Paso, sits in the middle between, you know, Nuevo Laredo and Tijuana on the west side. And they're fighting for control of that middle corridor, basically, is the way I see it.
Brad, any comments?
Dale, you're absolutely right. We have an annex in El Paso, and we're operating in Juarez every day. And think of that whole southwest border region, in particular that corridor, like a monopoly board. Where you grew up is Boardwalk and Park Place for anybody who is trafficking any kind of anything. So whether it be tobacco products that are counterfeited and then brought into the United States to be sold to avoid any levies or taxes or anything like that, or if we're talking about true narcotics trafficking, your proximity to the border is going to be the most expensive real estate. So again, we've been referring to organized crime as like Fortune 10 corporations, and they're going to make a business case out of that real estate. And that is why the area that you grew up in, you've seen such a rapid decline, because everybody is fighting over Boardwalk and Park Place, just like Monopoly.
Thank you, Dale. Appreciate it. Mike in Decatur, Illinois, on the wildcard line. Good morning, Mike.
Yes, George Knapp, I'm glad to speak to you. I've been a Coast listener for years, and I want make a statement to this gentleman and ask him a serious question. Being with our president, the one we elected, he's got all these security things under these new things that he operated. Would this agency or this particular agency, would they go against the citizens and go after people like myself, patriots, or anybody that the government deals as so-called terrorists because they disagree with the guy, not because of his race? And I lost my job in 06 under very serious, weird circumstances by being set up by somebody at my job after 38 years involved all kinds of weird stuff. And it had to been some kind of an organization that had powerful swings in the county as well as the university. And the citizens got me completely kicked out and got me fired from my job after 38 years under false charges. And with the union, I couldn't prove either way. I had to just get up and I lost my rights. I had people in the apartment spying on me, and I had my phones bugged, and the sheriff and the police kept coming over saying that people were making complaints and I was going to threaten people and all kinds of weird stuff. And I finally had to get up and move. And I know that it had something to do with a lot of the history that I know and stuff at the end of the war. And I'm just wondering if this, with this organization, or, and I personally believe that maybe that Obama will create some kind of a problem where he'll be like Roosevelt, where they get us into a shooting match with somebody and we won't be, we won't have an election. So, but I'm more worried about these private contractors being paid by the government or somebody else to come after us. So I'll go ahead and take my thing off the air, and a lot of people know me. Thank you.
Mike raises interesting points there. I guess, Brad, maybe one way to ask the question is to say, are there companies like yours, not necessarily yours, but that do dirty tricks like that, maybe at the behest of government clients?
Sure. Well, first, that's a shame that after so much loyalty to your corporation, they pulled that trick on you. That's unfortunate. There's a private court contractors and private companies don't have any kind of law enforcement capability in an official sense. Here in the United States, a company like ours is limited on what type of things that we can do because the law. There's law enforcement that does a lot of the things that we're talking about. So that's why organizations like ours can do quite a bit more outside of the United States. I see no evidence and I see no indicators that a private organization or a private militia or any kind of private entity with any type of capability would rise up against the citizens. I think that Americans are patriotic. They love their country. And as soon as people start to even get a whiff that something like that is going to take place, all hell is going to break loose. And I think that there would be a borderline revolution if something like that happened.
Back to the other part of the question, are there others maybe less scrupulous in your line of work that would do stuff like dirty tricks or target Americans for something that maybe wouldn't be completely legal?
I think that if something like that were to happen, people would rise up in mass, and whoever tried to do something like that would have to face the zombie apocalypse in all its glory.
Okay. International Line, Samuel in Toronto. Good morning, Samuel.
Good morning to both of you as well. I just wanted to ask a question. Was there ever a day where you were forced to go against an individual's constitutional rights in order to do your job, regardless of if you had evidence or just had a gut feeling? And does your company protocol have as much jurisdiction to make that type of decision based on what you guys are doing on a humanitarian level? And was there ever a lawsuit filed against your company?
Okay, Three questions. First, the last one first. No, we've never had any lawsuits filed against us in any capacity. Second question. In disasters like California firestorms, Katrina, the floods in the Midwest, in particular the floods in Iowa, when organizations like ours deploy, the governor or the president of the United States declares it a national disaster. Now, when a natural disaster or a national disaster has been declared, a lot of the normal things that occur get suspended. FCC relaxes a little bit. Health and Human Services increase their capacity where normally they don't. Some of the incident command roles and responsibilities and levels of authority start to shift a little bit so that organizations can collaboratively do stuff. An example of that might be the Red Cross's ability to administer drugs in the field, things of that nature. So, okay, I got two and three. What was that first question, George?
Samuel, I think you've sort of answered it as well. Samuel, are you still there? I think he's gone. I think you hit on most of the stuff that he was asking. East of the Rockies, Josie in South Florida. Hi, Josie.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
I just had a comment and a question. My comment was about the 99%. The 99% isn't only about a hacker group. I mean, I'm part of the 99%, and I'm a network engineering specialist, and I don't hack into people's computers and make demands on people to get people harmed. And I think the 99% is just really out there trying to let our nation know that we're not going to be putting up with governments creating laws just to self-serve themselves using laws, like two-tiered law system. And second, my question for this gentleman is that would you, if ordered, because you do have a lot of special forces and people like that in your group, go against the American people if ordered to do so? And I just feel that a lot of the targets that you have to go after are a failure because are they being run by government operations such as the Operation Fast and Furious, where Border Patrol agents were killed by guns that were being smuggled into by Mexican cartels? But my main question was that, would you go against the American people if ordered to do so by the government and harm, civilians? Because that's who the greatest victim of all would be in this nation.
The answer to that would be absolutely, uncategorically, no. And I got a nice little trend here I'm picking up. That's the second time I've been asked in three questions on whether or not we go against the American citizens. So just to be clear, HALO started in emergency response and disaster management. So HALO is an acronym that stands for Humanitarian Assistance Logistics Operations. We only come in to do things to help people when others can't. We fill the gaps that exist when people are trying to increase survivability and reduce morbidity and mortality, and they're not doing it as effectively as they can. We're not a private military organization or a mercenary group. The fact that some of our employees have a military background with an emphasis in special operations, I would remind folks that a lot of companies hire the military, and I would encourage people to hire veterans. So the only real distinction is that we have retired special operations people that work for the company, and we would never turn on the citizens. We're actually here to help fill gaps, to keep people out of crisis and to solve problems when we're called.
Josie, appreciate that. West of the Rockies, Sonia in Sacramento. Good morning, Sonia.
Good morning, George. I love it when you're on.
Thank you. Thanks.
I'd just like to say to HALO, I love what you guys are doing. I've been watching your show, and I had a company back in the day. I'm a retired contractor myself, and we used to go down to South America, Latin America. We did very similar work to what you're doing now, and it seemed to me that in Colombia, when Escobar was killed and then when Noriega was taken out of the picture in Panama, we noticed a huge influx of really well-trained smugglers and drug movers, I guess you could say, moving up towards Mexico because there was less heat there, and they really got well-established and well-rooted. We saw this happening, and even though I ran the company, it was because I was a retired analyst, not because I was, you know, specialty in my specialty was not special forces, although the guys that worked for me were veterans because my husband and I are both veterans. So we naturally hired people we knew and some that we didn't know that were just highly respected, even SAS. We had some SAS guys there. But, you know, we worked with several senators in the United States and whatnot, but we didn't do any work in the inside of the United States either. We more things like rescuing farmers in Costa Rica, you know, just people that found themselves in the wrong place at the wrong time and just the wrong surroundings. People that got hung up, so to speak, in different areas. You know, sometimes even in places like Nigeria or whatever, we would go in and we would negotiate, you know, sometimes for their release. I think what we did was probably more like the movie Proof of Life than possibly what I've seen of your stuff on TV. And I know that that shows a very limited portion of what you're capable of doing, so I'm not making any judgments there. I think what you're doing is outstanding, and it takes an incredible amount of courage and money and time and heart and disregard for your personal self and your personal time to do what you do, and I just wanted to say thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, I can't thank you enough for just taking the time to say that and sitting on hold just so that you could say that to me, and I want to just repay that to you. It sounds like that you've you and I have chewed on some of the same dirt, and for a lot of the same reasons. So to you and your husband and the work that you were doing, we thank you for your service to the country and what you decided to do to serve others after you retired. So God bless you for that.
Appreciate the call, Sonia. About the TV shows, Brad, are you asked to do things that sort of go against the grain? And I ask it in this context. I've seen so many of these UFO-related shows, for example, how they handle stories that I'm familiar with, and what you see on the air is a far cry from what the actual facts are. I just wonder, if have you been asked to do anything that's uncomfortable? I know in general, Discovery Channel has a pretty good reputation.
Well, we've done the Discovery Channel and History Channel, and we get asked to do a myriad of things, and I'm not quite sure why, but we get asked to do things that we know very little about, which is always just makes me scratch my head. But we're not trying to be TV people. We're not trying to get careers in TV or radio. We do TV and radio from time to time so that we can increase awareness that there are capabilities out there and there are options for people when they think that there's no hope and they think that they're not being heard, and they're basically looking for some type of alternative. We're there. And since we started doing media, there's been a huge amount of people that are drawing breath today because we came up with a crazy idea to start an organization like this.
Brad Barker is my guest, president and founder of Halo Corporation. We'll go back to the phones right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Brad Barker, president and founder of the Halo Corporation. The phone lines are full. We'll get to as many of your calls as we can right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Brad, a lot of folks on the phones wanting to talk to you. I wanted to give you a chance, though, before the end of the program to go ahead and give a plug for this counterterrorism summit you've got going. When is it, and who's invited?
Certainly. It's at the end of October. We've got a five-day counterterrorism summit that we put on every year for members of the local, state, and federal law enforcement, military, and the intelligence community. It's in San Diego, and we have Governor Jan Brewer from Arizona attending, who's very progressive and forward-leaning. We have General Michael Hayden, former director of NSA, former director of CIA, Congressman Duncan Hunter, who is the former chairman of the Armed Services Committee, as well as 24 of the Halo folks. And for the first time ever, we've got arguably the best cybersecurity folks in the world, Black Hat. They are the top-notch folks in cybersecurity doing a five-day training, giving law enforcement the ability to learn how a lot of these folks perpetrate their crimes using technology as a force multiplier and using the veil of anonymity that exists throughout the internet. So it's going to be a monumental event. It's the first time anything like this has happened. It's the largest event of its kind in the country.
And San Diego is not a bad place to be in October or any time, really.
It's true enough. We call it home.
Back to the phones. First-time caller Cynthia in Marietta, Georgia. Good morning, Cynthia.
Morning. I love your show. I can see why Mr. Barker's company's name Halo, because we're blessed to have somebody like that does that line of work. I will try to be very quick. I know you're at the end of the show. I have a friend that is an ex-military wife who was married to somebody in special forces. During the time that she was married to him, it was really a very tragic kind of marriage, abuse, and a lot of cover-up going on by the military. And you'll have to trust me, but we won't go into every little detail about that. She was married to this gentleman around 7 years, but a total of 17 and a half. And at the 7-year mark, she ended up finding out that he was a family of mafia. But I believe possibly after hearing your show, may have been carteled into that higher echelon connected with the Mexican cartel. He had a background of Puerto Rican, and family came from, of course, domineering Puerto Rico. He, the husband, stole a $200,000 18-wheeler. The mother was a nurse and had killed 4 people. It got covered up and got reported. The parents of the mother-in-law, we believe, was murdered by her injecting them. The lady had a heart condition, but had a brand new stent, fairly new, and had the best you could have in medical, and ate very healthy, but unexpectedly ended up dead. The husband was in the next bed. He ended up dead 5 weeks later. All the bank accounts were cleaned prior to the death, and the person that was forced to stay married to this individual up until 17 and a half years, and they broke at the 10-year mark, waited and waited for those years.
Hey, Cynthia, this is a really interesting story, but I need you to get to the point for Brad.
Well, basically, they're now divorced, and documents pertaining to some of these incidents that we didn't believe the military really knew about, they end up getting somebody through the military to date the daughter and come in and steal the documents that they had originally thrown the person off the base, saying they didn't believe it. And it's been one nightmare after another. They also ran the Department of Defense.
Cynthia, I'm going to ask you again, though. You need to bring this to a question for Brad.
Okay. What's behind this, that this stuff's going on this many years?
You know, it sounds like a tragic story. It sounds like there's a whole lot of details and information that this is probably not the forum to discuss that, but I know that the military has tremendous internal law enforcement investigative capabilities within CID, and if there's the assumption that there's some double dealings or some nefarious activity going on, it should be reported.
Cynthia, I appreciate that. That is an interesting story. I'm sorry we're not able to really give you direct answers to it, but I think Brad's point is that it's a tough one to tackle in a radio conversation from afar, but I appreciate you calling. Going to go east of the Rockies, Ben in Chicago. Hi, Ben. Ben's no longer there. All right. How about up to our wild card line, Sandy in Normal, Illinois. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Great show. And I appreciate all the work he's doing. One, how many people do you employ? Two, I know someone that's gotten mixed up with a gangbanger, and there are several gangs here in the town, and we're trying to get her away from him. And you said that the tentacles reach out to the smaller towns through the gangs. So wonder if that would be possible to reach as far as her, because we worry about it all the time. And three, have you done any investigation on Natalie Holloway? That is something that has just bothered me for so long, and I feel so bad for that mom. And I think, my own opinion, I think she was sold into sex slavery, but I don't know. They said that they sent a private investigator down there, and he was warned to get out of town in Venezuela. So they said it was 20 minutes from where Aruba was by boat. So I don't know. But those are my three questions, okay? And thank you. And, George, you're great, okay?
Thanks, Sandy. Brad?
Certainly. Okay, so I'll start with number two, because it seems to be the most critical. With regard to the young lady in your neighborhood that you're referring to, that you suspect she might have some type of gang ties, you know, to be fair, if kids, when they get to a phase where we're going to rebel against their families, they have a couple of ways that they can get themselves out of a situation like that. Academics is one. Sports is another. Working with the community or getting involved with a church group or organization where they can be part of a family, be part of a collective, and have some type of belongingness is really the solution. Usually kids go to gangs because they feel disenfranchised, they don't feel connected to anything. They didn't make the sports team. They didn't get into music or whatever. And the gang seems like a reasonable alternative because people have money. They are throwing parties all the time. And quite frankly, they do a much better job at recruiting than coaches or member of the clergy. So what you need to do is surround her with love, try to get her connected to something that is going to benefit her much more so than the gang. There might be some resentment, and you might have quite a few arguments, but you have to be diligent and you have to be persuasive. Otherwise, you could lose her. That's a critical thing, and it's happening to a lot of America's youth right now. And I appreciate you asking the questions.
What about Natalie Holloway? And let me broaden the question. Does your company investigate missing persons cases in general?
Constantly. Unfortunately, missing children is the number one phone call we get. The Natalie Holloway case, some of the world's subject matter experts have been involved in that. A close colleague of ours, Mr. Ty Ritter, has been involved in the Natalie Holloway case. We, as HALO, have not, but it's tragic in any view. Now, the ones that hit the media get a lot of celebrity and a lot of resources and assets thrown at them. These cases are, there's several of them that you never hear about that are happening on a daily basis. This is a huge concern. If you look at the Department of Justice website, you have about 260,000 kids go missing every single year. 260,000. We're talking about two or three right now on this show. So imagine 50 states, 260,000 in the course of a year. I mean, this is an overwhelming issue. And we need to shine a bright light at this and let the schools and the parents and the church groups and the community groups know that this is a situation and it's a tremendous vulnerability.
How many of those are parental abductions? You know, the non-custodial parent grabs the kid out of school.
Great question. We call that a domestic kidnapping. That's where a biological parent takes a child without the permission of the other biological parent, whether they're in wedlock or out of wedlock or whatever. And there is a huge amount of moving children over state borders and over international borders. This is a regular occurrence. Now, of all the cases that we get that are easy to solve, I mean, this is low-hanging fruit for us because you can consult with the families. It's not a kinetic event. No one's being injured or harmed. You know, it's not a good thing, but it's very easy to pass on this information to law enforcement, and we can begin to liaise with whatever the country is that where they currently reside, whether it be Canada or Mexico. And these can be solved pretty easily for not a lot of money, and no one gets injured. And we get a lot of those. Not everything we do is, the high-profile cases that are in the media and whatnot. But when the sun is out and the birds are chirping and we're not doing these types of operations, we are training people on how to reduce their threat profile, reduce their vulnerabilities, and what to do in case something like this occurs.
What do you have any numbers on the non-parental abduction, just stranger abductions of kids in America, and what's your track record in tracking that kind of stuff down?
You know, it's funny because each jurisdiction, each region, whether it be city, county, or state, they all have a different metric on how they report these types of things. There's not a standardized reporting mechanism across all 50 states on how an abduction or a kidnapping or a runaway or just a missing person is recorded or cataloged. Now, again, in the United States, when we get calls of that nature, we instantly bring in law enforcement. Again, HALO's a private consultancy, and we don't want to give somebody a love note in the form of an invoice for something that could be done for free. So we instantly get them in touch with the local investigators, detectives, sheriff's office, and if it's something that has to do with several states, then we're going to get the FBI involved, and we have great relationships with these agencies. And then once it goes international, then we can weigh in, and we can actually be effective and have some merit.
Again, back to the central part of that question, the number, do you have an idea on how widespread it is for just strangers snatching a kid?
So, yeah, the way I address that is in each community, the metrics on how they tabulate the numbers and what their actual report card is so varying. So
yeah.
Even the Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, and the local sheriff's department, and local police department, when they look at the exact same data, they report it differently. So I could throw you a number, but it's not going to have
right.
Any relevance because the corresponding agency down the street is going to look at that same topic and have a completely different number. So,
well, how about characterizing it then? Is it widespread or is it pretty rare?
No, it's actually very widespread because it's profitable for the people that perpetrate the crimes. Again, this is a revenue stream. This is an influx of finances for these criminal groups that are using money to buy weapons, to buy influence, and to buy off officials. So they're going to get money any way they can. Human trafficking is and kidnapping is one of several. And they run these businesses like well-oiled machines. They've got a full-on end-to-end logistics and supply chain. They've got a customer. They've got a product. They've got a method of delivery. They've got an unlimited amount of resources as far as product because of social media. Facebook is a huge vulnerability because young people are putting their pictures and the things that they do and that they like and personal information about each other out on the web for all to see. And bad people that plan to do bad things can grab that information and put together a profile of their victim and be able to use some just very basic elicitation techniques and pretexting and develop some trust and rapport to these victims, and they can get them into their car. And once they're in the car, it's over.
That's very important information for parents to keep in mind. Steve in Denver, Colorado, on the Wild Card line. Hi, Steve.
Hey, George. Thanks for taking my call. Great show again. As usual, you guys are the best. And hey, Brad, I want to say thanks for taking my call. You're doing God's work. This is really awesome to be talking to you. I wanted to ask you, first, I also want to say as a veteran, you know, thanks for saying that, encouraging small businesses in America and big businesses to hire veterans. As a veteran myself, I work as a private investigator. I wanted to ask you, for your company, I haven't seen the shows yet, so you might answer this in some of the TV shows, but I wanted to know, what's the personal toll on your operators? Do they maintain normal family lives, or is it hard like everyone else in law enforcement and the military? And the other question I had was, how do you guys take proactive security measures to protect your operators when you guys are crossing so many bad guys?
Good question.
Great questions. So, okay, so the first one, when we recruit people for the company, they have a specific background. They've been, many of them have done at least 10 years or so in special operations. So regardless of the branch of the military, they've already been through a rather rigorous selection process, and they've made through that. And then they've been deployed on behalf of the federal government into areas of war and conflict around the world. So they've been there, done that, got the t-shirt, they've looked the enemy in the eye, and they've learned from that experience. When they retire from the military with that skill set, the job market for somebody who wants to keep those skills, I mean, you can't go sell cars at the local dealership with that background unless you completely want to switch off and put that chapter of your life behind you. So we can take folks that have this background, in particular, the tactical combat casualty care capabilities, so that they can be forward deployed medics and really help people downrange or in some of these situations. So they can maintain a pretty solid family life. Now, we don't work in cubicles in an office building, and we don't do the 9-to-5 thing. And we don't take weekends off. And, you know, when 5 o'clock rolls around, we don't, you know, slide out like Fred Flintstone and yabba dabba doo. It's the weekend, you know, we'll come back. We're a 24/7 shop. We keep non-conventional hours. When we're operational, and everything else is secondary. Now, as far as the family life goes, if you're a spouse of somebody who works here, you're pretty much used to this lifestyle because the person has already lived a decade or so in the special operations process. So let's say a wife who marries an operator, I mean, she married an operator. She knew what she signed up for. So I hope that adequately answers your question. Now, the second part is our operational security. You know, we take that very seriously because we're in the media. We do stuff like this, and there are, believe it or not, some folks that don't like us to be around. And we've been targeted before. We get death threats regularly, and we take all kinds of precautions to make sure that not only our principals are fine, but also our operators. And
Brad, I'm gonna have to leave it there. We're out of time. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks so much, George.
It went fast, didn't it? Brad Barker, president and founder of Halo. Hope you'll keep us in mind. You get some really interesting cases pop up, and you'll come back and see us. Thanks also to Bill Black, my first hour guest, and to David, Lex, and Jason there at Coast to Coast. I'll be back next Sunday, and also at the fifth Sunday this month, I'll be here with that mafia show that so many of you listeners had asked for. Got some real-life mafia survivors come here and join us and tell us about their experiences. Thanks, everyone. Good night.